Hello and welcome to the show that wants, nay demands, a six-season Netflix epic on the history of Charlton Athletic. This week on a show hopelessly compromised by unexpected absences, we look at Bristol City, the Championship's unexpected success story. We sent Matt Stanger to Charlton Athletic for the 25th anniversary of their return to the Valley, and he caught a cold, and he's in bed right now. So we'll do what we can without him. There was a big clash in League 2 this weekend, first versus second, Luton Town versus Notts County. We're all over that one. We've got most of the usual stuff, the histories, by thunder if we got the histories today, the fan league, the odds. The only thing we haven't got is Matt. It's the Totally Football League Show, in association with William Hill. Sue Cook's pulled out. Yep. Slight change to the programme today, ladies and gentlemen. Batting for Matt Stanger, we welcome David Priest back to the studio.
Second choice, but not the worst choice, though.
Second choice, Priesty. And in the absence of our advertised guest, Jason Newell, we've got Adam Bate from Sky.
Hello. Hello, Ian. I would rather be replacing Matt, I think. Set the bar low.
Poor Matt, he's going to be listening to this right now, feeling even worse. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. You're a Wolves fan, aren't you?
I am, yes. So this is probably
happy days.
Good chance to talk about them before they leave this show's realm, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that confident.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you, to be honest. They're really very good at football. All right, let's get cracking. Remember, guys, the door is open. This show's like the Liverpool team of the 1980s. People didn't want to get injured just in case they never got their place back, if you're listening, Matt. Let's go to the Championship. Ben, fire up the music. We here at the Totally Football League Show would like to apologise for suggesting that Wolves against Sunderland was the homiest home win in the history of football. We'd like to thank our guest James Brown for preserving a little of the show's credibility by reminding us that anything can happen, as it duly did. Wolves nil, Sunderland nil. Sorry. Elsewhere, Bristol City's extraordinary surge continues at an inversely proportional rate to Sheffield United's decline, the two lines crossing on Friday night when the Robins beat the Blades 2-1 at Bramall Lane. And Leeds United, who we might have mentioned once or twice last week, are just 4 points off the playoffs now, having beaten QPR 3-1.
Nigel Adkins enjoyed a flying start to life in Hull on Saturday. The Tigers held on to beat Brentford 3-2, and they've put 6 points between themselves and the drop zone. Birmingham, on the other hand, are deep in the sticky stuff. They've lost 1-0 at Fulham. They've only won once in their last six games, and the pressure's building again already. And it's already hard to see Burton surviving. They lost 2-1 at home to Preston, conceding the 40th goal of the season in the process.
Middlesbrough are back on track. They beat Ipswich 2-0 on Saturday, a result that just about keeps them in touch with the playoffs. Sheffield Wednesday had hopes of being up there with them and were leading Norwich 1-0 at half-time, only to lose 3-1. And Bolton's impressive response to that seemingly eternal run of defeats has been truncated by a 3-2 defeat to Nottingham Forest.
Derby County are absolutely flying. They start the season poorly, but their 3-0 away win at Barnsley lifts them to fourth in the table. They rose above Aston Villa, who drew 0-0 with Millwall. And there was another exciting finish to a televised Monday night game. Reading were leading Cardiff 2-0 with 7 minutes to go, only to let the Bluebirds back in into the game. First through Joe Bennett, and then in injury time, Lee Tomlin equalised. They're 4 points behind Wolves in second.
Ah, they certainly are. I didn't switch that one off in injury time. Learnt my lesson. Bristol City then, they finished 18th in 2016, held up by the goals of Jonathan Codger. They finished 17th in 2017, held up by the goals of Tammy Abraham. Manager Lee Johnson, son of former manager Gary Johnson, of course, seemed like he was on borrowed time after just one win in the first five games of the season. We all kind of expected the inevitable. But they've won six of the last eight, David.
I think it's a great case for somebody backing their manager and having a faith in the manager, because, I mean, they didn't have a great season last year either. And going into this year, there was still a lot of hope. Obviously, they probably didn't think they were going to be third at this point in the season. But what they have got there, they've got a real good group of players. And it's not just about recruitment. It's about once they get those players in, that they're big on the environment that they're creating. And they're creating a team that's where they don't want any passengers. They don't want anybody who's going to upset the apple cart. And as well as getting the right players in, I think a big part of their process was getting the wrong players out and making sure you got them out quickly. They seem to have got that now. And you can see that the way they're playing, they're very orientated on their set pieces. They score a lot of goals from set pieces. and it helps when you've got a goal scorer in centre half as well.
Absolutely, one who's 6 foot six. Adam, did you watch the game against Sheffield United on Friday night?
I did. I saw the four times they hit the woodwork.
So, yeah, incredible,
Sheffield,
wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, a little fortunate, I think, in that one. But it's the team spirit, isn't it? And it's late goals. I agree with David about the recruitment, because a lot of the key players there this season were there last season, weren't they? You would have thought losing Tammy Abraham, but it's players that were there like Corey Smith, and I think Nathan Baker has been just as important as Flint at the back. But I'm just interested to talk about Flint just because the amount of goals he scores. I just think you know, even if he's not that good a defender, you know, if he's making more mistakes than Baker or whatever, that's just an outrageous amount of goals to be scoring. 15 when they went up and 6 this season already. It's just extraordinary.
Well, they almost lost him, didn't they, David?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in the summer, it's no secret that Birmingham were trying to sign him before they signed Mark Roberts, and he just signed a new contract last season, which gave him a hefty pay rise. And I know they were perhaps a little disappointed that he might even think about moving to another Championship team, even though Birmingham again would give him another hefty pay rise. But they went the first month of the season without him because of this. You know, he's had his head turned, and all the way up to the transfer window closing, I think he probably has one eye on Birmingham as well. And since then, he's been the consummate pro, I think. He's got his head down, and to the point now where I think they're even considering extending his contract at Bristol City. So it's turned around totally for him. And you're right about his goal scoring. I think even in training on Thursday morning, he scored 4 goals from set pieces in just a one training session. So you
not
know,
not just headers either, are they? The volleys and all sorts.
He's composed, and even though when it comes to being the defender, He sticks his head on it. He's an all-out defender, but he has brought that other part of it into his game. He is more of a, you know, he is trying to play a little bit more rather than just being that header and kick type of defender.
Let's talk about that game just a bit. Lee Johnson said afterwards it had to change the tactics 3 times during the game to respond to what Sheffield United were doing. Now, on the one hand, that's really good. That's great that the manager's accepting it. But also it does indicate that Sheffield United were kind of pulling them all over the place for much of the game, doesn't it?
Well, I think the key to it was that they were playing 3 at the back, and it's almost like they've got overlapping centre-halves. So both centre-halves join in, and they're overloading the midfield, and it becomes a real problem, especially when you go into pressing it, and it brings you out of your shape and they just start passing around you. And it wasn't until they went to 3 at the back themselves that Bristol City really got a hold on it. And of course, the sending off changes things in their favour as well. But
yeah, let's review that for a moment. Adam, you've seen it, the John Fleck 2-footed tackle on Corey Smith. Chris Wilder said after the game, he said, "The game is gone if you can't tackle like that now." That was just a proper tackle, was it?
No. I mean, he's got quite a nasty gash on his leg, hasn't he? There's talk of him maybe being out briefly for a game or two, which would be a big miss. He's an important player for them. Jamie Patterson's, they look a different team when he plays as well. Just to go back to what David said about being a good example of sticking with a manager, I think this is the new sort of Sir Alex Ferguson for sticking by a manager, really, for the new generation, because there's going to be loads of Football League managers saying, "Look, he lost 8 in a row, don't sack me, you know, you can turn it around." And there weren't the clues that this was going to happen. Then he sacked the assistant manager with 10 to go, they're in the relegation zone. It's extraordinary, really.
It doesn't happen very often, does it? In fact, I'm struggling to think of a recent example of a manager really... I mean, he'd lost the fans, hadn't he?
Yeah, well, it happened to him before at Barnsley as well, to be honest. I mean, I think they maybe went 11, 12 games without winning before they started to turn around at Barnsley. But if you look at the team that came up with Paul Heckenbottom and the players they've sold, a lot of them were signed under Lee Johnson as well, likes of Alfie Mawson, Conor Hooran... Marley Watkins. So recruitment is, if he's given enough time, it's clear that he's got the right skills in the recruitment area to make a success if he's given it long term.
And Bobby Reid scored a lot of goals for them. I mean, he scored more goals this season in by mid-August than he scored last season.
Yeah, they're never short of a goal scorer, are they? Let's turn our attention to the big question, though. Can they go up? Bristol, of course, the biggest city never to have had a top-flight football team. Does that end this year?
I think it's going to be difficult. They've got some big games coming up. I mean, just over Christmas, either side of New Year, they've got Wolves and Aston Villa with one day in between. They've got Man United game coming up. So there's some big games coming up over Christmas. I think, you know, this might be my Jimmy Hill moment with the Romania team in the 90s, where he said about the blonde hair and it being an important, that they could spot them in their peripheral vision. So you're going to laugh at me, but I think the gifts are the key.
Do you know what? I agree with you. I think it could be. But expand.
Well, if you've recorded that gif as Santa Claus or Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, that, you know, cold hard cash is a motivator with goal bonuses. But I don't, David, was that goal bonuses weren't a big thing for you? But I reckon this could be the thing. If you've recorded that, you want to score your goal, don't you?
You want to score your goal, so you know, get yourself
the warm embrace
viral.
Of social media. That is what we live for, isn't it?
It hasn't been warm for a while, but.
But like I said before about the recruitment, it's not just about, they haven't just gone for talented players yet. It's important, but they've went for the right characters. And all these gifts, it's all part of what they're trying to do there. Yeah. They're all trying to build the right environment for them to succeed.
No, we spoke about this briefly last week. James Brown wasn't massively impressed, but I think it speaks well of the spirit and the club. You know, because clubs can have kind of broken relationships across departments, and QPR in particular over recent years. I know there's been problems behind the scenes there. But if you've got a press department doing that and you've got the players getting involved, it kind of speaks well for the atmosphere.
Yeah, and I think you probably wouldn't do it if you weren't, things weren't going well.
Yeah.
If that was Aidan Flynn scoring a goal in a 3-1 defeat, I don't think they'd be tweeting gifts out.
Yeah, narrow victories as well are a sign of a good team spirit, aren't they? And hanging on and that sort of thing.
Producer Ben tells me if they do go up, they shouldn't have any problem attracting players, because Bristol was voted the best city to live in Britain in the Sunday Times Best Places to Live Guide of 2017, and one of the 10 happiest cities to work in the UK. Is that your experience of Bristol?
Yes, I've never been.
David, fan of Bristol?
It's a very good night out.
Yeah?
Some very good bars. That's the extent of my knowledge of Bristol.
I can also tell you that Hollywood legend Cary Grant, who, like yourself, had a magnificent moustache, he was born in Bristol as well.
Interesting.
Oh, there you go. If you want to go, and now would be a really good time to go and watch Bristol City. If you're not a member, you're looking at £26 to £36 for an adult ticket, under-12s for £10 to £15. There's very limited parking around Ashton Gate, and the club does encourage you to take the train. Parson Street Station is what you want, a 15-minute walk after that. Or how about taking a bike? There are 96 bicycle parking spaces available to supporters outside of the South Stand, and the club even provide a free bike pump. When we come back, we'll be playing the Fan League. Listeners, you like stats, and so do I. So have a bang on this one. 81% of men who try the Cornerstone Razor don't go back to their old one. I know. Find out more and get £10 off your first order and free delivery too at cornerstone.co.uk/totally. Right, time for the Fan League. You know how this works. It's an app. Type Fan League into the App Store. You find it there. You get a slip of 13 games and you just pick home win, away win or draw. It's as easy as that. There are, as I say, 13 games. About four or five of them are Championship games. We've got five this week for you. Let's start with Birmingham QPR. Adam, Birmingham. Birmingham are allergic to goals. 3 in the last 10 games. Can you see them turning it around here?
No, I'm going to go for a draw.
A draw?
Nil. Steve Cottrell claimed that they should have got something against Wolves despite not having a shot on target. I thought that was a bit.
That's a bold claim. David, QPR haven't won in 6, and you get the feeling if they don't win this one, it's going to look a bit tight for Ian Holloway.
I'm going to go for a 1-0 win for QPR.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I almost changed my mind when you told us they hadn't won in 6 games. No, but I will go 1-0, yeah, I think they're
there. Yeah, I think QPR would just about edge this. I'm never confident backing a team that can't score goals at all. Derby against Aston Villa. I'm not sure what to make of Aston Villa this season. They don't seem quite there. But Derby are in good form right now. Fantastic win away at Barnsley last weekend. They're up to 4th now. David?
They've only lost one goal in 5 games, so it's difficult to see them getting beat.
Yeah.
I'll go for 2-1 Derby.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'll go the same, actually. That's what I was going to say.
Another Derby win.
I think just when Villa get momentum, they seem to lose it, don't they?
Yeah, I can't quite see Villa making automatic promotion. I think they'll make the playoffs, but yeah, I think home win there as well. Right, tricky one. Millwall against Middlesbrough. Millwall, decent record at the Den, beating some big teams there. Borough, another team who can't quite get their season going. Good win over Ipswich last weekend, but I don't know which way this is going to go, so I'm just going to say draw. David?
I'm going to go for 3-1 Millwall.
Whoa, big shout.
Yeah.
Okay. Adam, is he mad?
No, I'll say 2-1 Millwall.
Whoa.
I think Gary Monk's in a bit of trouble.
Unless we're both mad.
That's a lot of love for the Lions. Gary Monk's former club, Leeds, they're at home to Norwich. Now, Leeds have won 3 in their last 5. James Brown last week, he said that he felt they'd come through that wobble. But Norwich had a good result last weekend, first win in ages, coming back against Sheffield Wednesday. So it's another difficult one. On balance, though, Leeds at Elland Road. It'll take something to stop me saying home win there.
I don't know. Did you see the little video of Gattuso? It was going around saying it was this is what Leeds are like, and it was sometimes maybe good, sometimes maybe bad. He didn't use those words. That's exactly what Leeds are. So it's either going to be 3-0 Leeds or 3-0 Norwich. So I'm going to go for 3-0 Leeds.
Okay, Adam.
I'll disagree and go 2-2.
Now, final one, Preston against Sheffield United. I know Sheffield United haven't had very good results recently. Their form doesn't look great. But I'm not sure they're in decline. After hitting the post 4 times against Bristol City, I'm backing them to win this, get back on track.
Not just that, it was a wonder save by Frankie Fielding as well.
Oh, yeah. Forgot
about
that.
Unbelievable save, yeah. Yeah, fancy Sheffield United. 2-0 Sheffield United.
Adam?
I'll go 2-1 Sheffield United.
Okay. All right, well, that's the Fan League. If you want to play along with us, download the Fan League from the App Store. Then find me, Ian McIntosh, and you can join the Totally Football League. When we come back, League One. All right, time for League One. Wigan move 4 points clear at the top of the division after a straightforward 2-0 victory over Fleetwood Town. Not a single shot on target there for Uwe Rosler's men. It's 5 wins on the bounce for Matt Stanger's Blackburn Rovers. Not that he owns them, but I think their situation would be improved if he did. They beat Peterborough 3-2 away from home. Rovers are third. And are a point Richie Wellens' campaign further vindicated this week by their 5-1 win over Northampton. The Sexy Owls are up to 16th now. They're only 9 points off the playoffs.
After back-to-back defeats, Shrewsbury need a late Sean Wally goal to salvage a point away at MK Dons. Charlton's playoff push was damaged by their 1-0 defeat at home to Portsmouth. Pompey with 4 wins in 6 now, and you have to feel sorry for Rochdale. They kept pegging Bradford back, only to lose 4-3 in the end. The Bantams are just 2 points off Shrewsbury now.
Everyone loves a relegation knife fight, and they don't get more dramatic than Plymouth's 2-1 win over fellow strugglers Gillingham. 1-1 after 90 minutes, and then... come on, Ian, you practice that. Diogo Raga scores the winner for the Pilgrims. Speaking of last-minute winners, Oxford manager Pep Clotet took to Twitter again to thank the supporters for driving his team on to their last-gasp 1-0 win over Doncaster. They're up to 8th. And Scunthorpe's fine form was ended on Saturday. They lost away to Walsall.
Rotherham finally won a game. 2 goals from David Ball sealed an excellent comeback away at Blackpool. It felt like a promotion, said manager Paul Warne. They're 6 points off the playoffs, so a real one isn't out of the question. It might be out of the question for Southend, though, Ian. They were walloped 3-0 by Bristol Rovers. As for Bury and Wimbledon, their game was postponed. Bury remain bottom, Wimbledon are 20th.
So, from what we've learned since we started this Football League odyssey, football clubs were generally formed in the Victorian era by factory workers or churchgoers, or in Wickham's case, bespoke luxury chairmakers. Cholton, though, they were formed in 1905 by kids. Teenagers who like to kick about. They got their red and white kit from a local draper's, they stuck an ad in the paper for opponents, and they entered the Lewisham League in 1906. They meandered around South East London, making their home on the Woolwich Common, on Pound Park, on the Angestine Athletic Ground, but they were always overshadowed by their illustrious neighbours Arsenal. In 1913, however, Arsenal pulled an MK Dons and skipped off to a more prosperous location. Of course, 1 year later, there were rather more important things to worry about. But when that ended, Cholton found their spiritual home, a sand and chalk pit known as the Swamps. It wasn't even big enough for a football pitch, so everyone had to grab a shovel and literally dig out the pitch. And that pitch became known as the Valley. In 1920, Cholton went professional. In 1923, they went on a bit of an FA Cup run, beating 3 First Division clubs and making the quarterfinals. But it didn't spark much interest in the team, and they left the Valley for a brief dalliance in Catford. That didn't last. Jimmy Seed became manager in 1933, but he had to find a new goalkeeper the following year when his first choice, Scotsman Alex Wright, was killed in a freak accident. After a brilliant performance against Torquay the day before, Charlton's players were relaxing in the sea. Wright dived headfirst off a diving raft, but didn't realise that the water was only 3 foot deep, perhaps even less, according to the inquest that followed, and he broke his neck, dying in hospital later. Seed, however, continued the work. He led Charlton to the second division in 35 and the first division in 36, and where did they finish in 37? Only bloody second behind Man City. And the Valley, the place that had struggled for crowds, they got 75,000 there in 1938 for a cup tie with Villa. They finished top four three times in the late 30s. And I tell you, when the 1939-1940 season began, they had really high hopes. Seed was still there after the Second World War, and in 1947 he won the FA Cup at Wembley. But the good times didn't last. He was sacked in 56, Charlton were relegated in 57. The following season, however, saw the greatest comeback in football ever. Istanbul. In 1958, Charlton were 5-1 down to Bill Shankly's Huddersfield with 28 minutes left and 10 men on the field, and they won 7-6. 60s weren't so hot. Charlton went from the second to the third in 72, bubbled between the two for a bit, narrowly avoided bankruptcy in 84, and were forced to leave the Valley in 85 for a spell at Selhurst Park. Despite all of that, Lenny Lawrence got them up to the First Division in 86, stayed there after winning the playoffs, these being the days when the fourth bottom team had to scrap it out with three upstarts from the Second Division. They survived on the last day in 88 as well, relegating Chelsea in the process. In 89, a way back to the Valley was found, but it depended on thousands of volunteers getting themselves over there to basically weed the terraces. Greenwich Council tried to get in the way, so they set up their own political party, the Valley Party, to contest local elections. In 1990, though, Charlton were finally relegated and Lenny Lawrence left. He was replaced by the untested player partnership of Alan Kirbishley and Steve Gritt. In 1992, they returned to the Valley, triumphant in more ways than one. They beat Portsmouth 1-0, and now we have to fast forward. They played their part in another of the greatest games ever, beating Sunderland on penalties in the playoff final at Wembley in 1997 after a 4-4 draw. They stayed in the top flight for 10 years under Kirbishley, the last couple of seasons characterised by a number of Charlton fans phoning 606, plaintively begging for Kirbs to be sacked and replaced by someone to take them to the next level. In 2006, a tag team of Ian Dowie, Les Reed and Alan Pardew duly obliged, and they haven't been back since. If it was down to me, I'd spend another 10 minutes telling you all how wonderful Chris Powell is, but let's finish in 2014 with the takeover of the club by Roland Duchelet, which on balance has not gone well. Charlton hasn't been a happy place for a while. It isn't sorted yet, even with Duchelet's recent pledge to leave, but manager Carl Robinson has certainly helped. Guys, you still with me?
Yes.
That what feels that, like 20 minutes?
That's therapy for the Charlton fans, isn't it, really? Because it shows that in the context of this mess, it's actually there's been some low times.
So much history.
There's been no diving incidents.
No.
Of that kind.
I'll tell you what, I should just say, if you enjoyed that, who wouldn't, follow the Charlton Athletic Museum on Twitter. That is at C-H-A-T-H Museum. So, Carl Robinson, a sort of peace has broken out. He's the only, David, he's the only kind of manager who could have come in and taken this, isn't he, with his personality?
I think that's what clubs like Charlton need. You know, he's in a long line of managers now who are not just battling against other sides, they're battling against his own owners, his own board. And I think sometimes you need that. Sunderland's need that for a long time, somebody to front up to the owner and the board and to really challenge them rather than just going along with whatever they say, because obviously it's they're going in the wrong direction. And he's certainly sort of, maybe it's abrasive is not the right word, but he's combative and he will have a go at anybody who gets in his way. And I think he's the right man for the job at the moment.
I mean, Duchelet mercifully appears to have given up. He said that it was a mistake getting involved in Charlton, which is certainly true. He wants to sell the club and leave. What was it that went wrong there for him?
Well, I think a big factor in it was the forcing players on coaches and managers that they didn't want. Whether they were good players or not, it's difficult for a manager or a coach to accept being told by somebody else how to do your job, basically. And so those players never really stand a chance. I mean, it's, you know, you've got great links to Belgium, and Belgian league's a great sort of source to be mined for players. But I think it's always going to be upset the apple cart, and it's always going to be friction between management and coaches and owners if that's going to be the case.
Yeah, Chris Powell, who brought them back from the third division, of course, dismissed shortly afterwards, after the takeover, which is a hell of a thing to do when it's Chris Powell. And I'm not just saying this because I adore him, but he was a hero there.
Yeah, of course. And then the rest of the staff that stayed there for a little bit longer, it just all turned sour. And it's hard enough to win football matches when when you've got everything on a level playing field, but when you're fighting against what's upstairs and there's so much, I don't know, animosity between people and between different departments, it just makes it so much more difficult.
It's a bit of a thin squad. Robinson's doing very, very well there. A couple of players stand out, though. For me, Ricky Holmes, who came through the Caroline Barker's Chelmsford City, as I believe we should refer to them. He's a fine talent, really mercurial winger, cuts in, causes all kinds of problems, and certainly caused Southend all kinds of problems earlier this season. But Ben Amos has caught the eye as well, hasn't he, David?
He has, and it's about time, really, for him. He spent a lot of his career at Manchester United, not got a lot of games under his belt for his age, 27 now, and it's about time that he played more regularly. Now he's on loan from Bolton, who signed for Manchester United, and his high wages there are a bit of a problem. That's why he's out on loan. So it's a great platform now for him to play games, and you'd like to think that they could make a more permanent deal.
And it wasn't a great day on Saturday. It's such a shame Matt isn't here, because he was actually at the game. So you have to forgive us if we're a little light on detail here. But it wasn't a great display by Charlton. Ben Amos, though, responsible for the only high point, that outstanding penalty save.
Yeah, it was a brilliant penalty save, and he's celebrated like all good penalty saves should be.
He's won the World Cup.
Yeah, exactly. It's a shame it was 1-0 down at the time.
It was a really soft penalty as well, wasn't it? I mean, if Jurgen Klopp saw that, he'd be like, OK, I really haven't got anything to complain about.
No, well, I mean, if you didn't hear the referee's whistle, you wouldn't have thought anything was going on. That was such a nondescript challenge.
Adam, Lee Bowyer's back.
Yes.
He's assistant manager now. There's a lovely piece, lovely interview by Nick Ames in The Observer a while back, if you're interested to go check that out. He's sort of rebuilding his reputation, isn't he?
Yeah, Carl Robinson likes to bring in these sort of... big name player. I remember Ian Wright was with him, wasn't he, at MK Dons. Yeah, I mean, I think he knows what he's doing in that league, doesn't he, Carl Robinson? He's had success there, and they've had some managers who don't have a clue about League One, and he seems to be somebody who, whatever owner comes in, he's someone who should stay.
Anyone want a Lee Bowyer fact?
Yes, please.
Oh, good man, good man. He left football behind to run a carp fishing lake in France. Now he's back, so carp fishing, obviously not that attractive.
No, he wasn't hooked by it, was he?
Oh. Matt's not here, but his terrible, terrible puns are. And, of course, the final question to be answered, the origins of the nickname Addicts. Do you know this, David?
Nope.
Adam, got anything? Right, I had this checked out by the Cheltenham Museum, who, again, you can follow on Twitter. Pre-Football League days, the players would treat the visiting team to a post-match meal of haddock and chips. The fishmonger who supplied them was one Arthur Bryan, who traded at nearby East Street. And by repute, he attended matches with a haddock nailed to a stick as an advertising stunt. Not a man you want to be sat anywhere near during the game, particularly in sunny weather. So, haddock... in southeast London, Addick, and they became the Addicts.
Wow.
Hey, every day's a school day. If you want to go see Cheltenham, you can get adult tickets for around about £20, depending on where you sit. Prices for under 11 start at £5. You can park at the Valley for £30 plus VAT. But Charlton Station is just a 3-minute walk. North Greenwich is the closest tube. That's 10 minutes away, but there's loads of buses. When we come back, we'll be looking at League Two. Welcome back to the Totally Football League Show in association with William Hill, and it's time for the League Two Roundup. It was all square in League Two's Clash of the Titans on Saturday. We'll hear a bit more about it in a sec, but Luton Town notched up their 35th home goal of the season in the first half, and then Notts County equalised through the timeless dominance of Shola Amiobi right on the hour. Morecambe had a massive win on Saturday, though. They beat Coventry 2-0. They would have been in the drop zone without those points. And the division's game of the day was almost certainly at the Rodney Parade, where Newport and Carlisle shared six goals in the space of 26 minutes and drew 3-3.
There was a massive win for Chesterfield this weekend. A last-minute goal from Robbie Weir snatched the 3 points for the Spireites, but it condemned Barnet to the foot of the Football League. Mansfield Town's inconsistency continues. They were beaten 2-0 by Harry Kewell's Crawley Town. Steve Evans was not amused. And things are picking up for Grimsby. They beat Forest Green 1-0. Mark Cooper's side at 23rd.
Lincoln City continue to battle away for a playoff place. They beat Yeovil 2-0 at the weekend. Wickham are only 3 points off that slot themselves, but their failure to beat Stevenage cost them the chance to narrow the gap. 0-0 there. And to continue a good weekend for teams who were tits deep in the brown stuff not so long ago, two goals for Christian Montano saw Port Vale rise up to the heady heights of 19th.
Crewe are still sliding down the table. They lost 1-0 away at Cheltenham and they're 22nd now, only out of the drop zone on goal difference. Remember early leaders Exeter and the way they smashed up with the division in the opening weeks? They're down to fourth after a surprise 3-1 defeat to Colchester. And Accrington Stanley against Swindon? Postponed. Accrington remain in third place.
Right, Luton Town. I promise I'll be quicker than 20 minutes this time. I'll be 19. Luton Town were formed in 1885, a merger between Posh People's Club, the Wanderers, quite a few of them knocking around, and the proletarian workers' team Excelsior. They played their games at Dallow Lane, a pitch next to a railway line, which meant if the wind was in the wrong direction, supporters might be engulfed in steam and have their hats blown from their heads. I'd like to thank the website The Beautiful History for that one. Luton were the first Southern team to turn professional. They were admitted to Division 2 in 1897. Unfortunately, most of the other teams were of the North and the travel expenses nearly killed the club outright. Tail between legs, they returned to the Southern League. They moved to Kenilworth Road in 1905 and joined Division 3 in 1920. They were promoted to Division 1 in 1955, reached the FA Cup final in 59 only to lose to Nottingham Forest. They dropped out of the top flight in 1960. They're in the 4th Division by 65. But then they bounced back. They won the 4th Division in 68, and they were back in the 1st for the 74-75 season. Only for one campaign, though. Luton's golden age? That was the 1980s. They rose back to the top flight under promising young manager David Pleat in 1982, and they stayed up on the last day of the following season thanks to a Radi Antic goal that brought that famous jig of delight from the manager. They weren't a popular team in the 1980s, Luton. They installed a plastic pitch in 1985, and after a terrifying night of violence before, during and after their clash with Millwall that year, Chairman David Evans, described in his Guardian obituary as the Thatcherite of Thatcherites, banned away fans and introduced an identity card scheme. "We became pariahs," David Pleat said. "He was a naughty boy, David. He was Mrs. Thatcher's plaything. He wanted a safe Tory seat. I didn't agree with it, but there was no discussion, no debate." Incidentally, have a read of Sean Ingle's piece in The Guardian on that game. It's brilliant. Luton finished 7th in 1987. They won the League Cup in 1988 after a dramatic Wembley tussle with Arsenal. That was the day that Andy Dibble's name was written into legend. They were back at Wembley the following year, but as they did in 1959, they lost to Nottingham Forest. Luton were one of the rebel clubs that voted to leave the Football League for the Premier League, but they were relegated in 1992 and they never got to play in it, pulling the ladder up and then falling through the trapdoor, doomed to spend the next 25 years wondering where the ladder had gone. And by thunder, did they pay a heavy price for that. After three seasons of struggle, they dropped into the third division in 96 and the fourth in 2001. And in 2003, John Gurney arrived. Now, Gurney, and I've had to keep this short, mooted merging with Wimbledon in order to get, and I quote, a backdoor into Division 1. He wanted to build a 70,000-seater stadium next to the M1 and change the club's name to match the airport. Yes, he wanted to call them London Luton. After sacking Joe Kinnear, he launched a Pop Idol-style phone poll to pick the next manager, which, by an extraordinary quirk, saw the cheapest option Mike Newell win, which was very handy because Newell had signed a contract an hour before the phone lines closed. In fairness, though, Newell actually did do quite well. So, how did the fans get Gurney out? Well, in the words of Jim White and The Telegraph, in a splendidly organised coup d'etat, they bought shares in a sleeping company which held a debenture on Luton's ground and then called in a multi-million pound debt. Gurney was declared bankrupt in 2008, and while we take absolutely no pleasure in another man's downfall, it is reassuring at least to know that he's now barred from taking over anyone else's football club. Newell, in the meantime, had taken Luton up to the second division, and they finished 10th in 2006, before plunging down to the fourth amid financial irregularity charges and massive, highly contentious point deductions, a 30-point deduction in one case. Relegation to non-league in 2009 was unstoppable. They came close to a swift return three times in 4 years, but then under the wise stewardship of the venerable John Still, they popped back up in 2014. They started well that year, but they fell away. Still was awarded the freedom of Luton in January 2015, but was sacked in December 2015. He was replaced, though, by Nathan Jones. We're not doing the Bananarama joke. It's been going pretty well since then, hasn't it, Adam?
Fantastic. I've interviewed Nathan Jones a couple of times, actually. The second time I interview him, I immediately put a bet on them to win the league, which isn't my reaction every time I interview a lower league manager, I can assure you.
What was it about him?
He's just, well, first of all, I think he's got an interesting background, having played in Spain as a young player. And he actually got homesick at Luton, ironically, there, and then went to Spain, which is a bit odd.
It's a lot better to be homesick if you're warm, though. And you've got a nice
that's true.
Yeah.
But I think he's got a really interesting blend in the coaching staff as well, because he leans heavily on Paul Hart, who was at Leeds and Forest, and a kind of a proper football man, and he trusts him a lot. But he's also got an assistant called Joaquin Gomez, who I've also done a piece with him, and he's another guy. He came to England in his late 20s, couldn't speak any English. He was a PE teacher in Spain, and he's working in coffee shops in Brighton, and worked his way up to part-time coaching. He became a video analyst with Nathan Jones at Brighton under Oscar Garcia. So there's this blend of kind of new ideas that, I mean, Nathan Jones is really into video analysis, but he's also got the guys on board, and he's just playing great football, but not afraid to mix it as well.
Yeah, this is something I've seen. I was at Newport on the old Rodney Parade pitch, which is basically a comprehensive school rugby pitch. It was absolutely teeming down with rain, and you could see straight away Luton were able to adapt to it. They didn't actually win the game, but they didn't get stuck in the mud. David, what have you made of them?
Well, for Nathan Jones, I found him a very sort of intense character. It's like when you were speaking to him, but he is very intense, and he's this new wave of managers who I think the influence he's had from Spain has helped as well. But he wants to learn all the time. He's not just content with the knowledge that he had of during his playing days. I think he realised that he didn't know as much as what he wanted to about the game, about coaching. And he went away, and he just wants to learn about everything from different facets of the game, from outside the game, and he brings it all together. And like you said, it's sometimes it's great to stick to your guns and believe in your philosophy, but sometimes in League One and League Two, it's not enough to do that. You do come and play in some terrible pitches, and it isn't conducive to good football. So you need to change it a little bit. And the fact that he does that and he is able to shift and change the way that his tactics and the way that he plays, it's what's going to get them into the next division above.
Players, they are so impressive every time you watch them. They score so many goals. They've hit 7-3 times already this season. And there's some really exciting young talent there. Most of it spawned by Rob Lee.
That's true. Yeah. Also, Steve Potts' son's there. Remember him, the West Ham captain. So there's a bit of a West Ham theme with Marek Štech in goal. He made a mistake against,
of course, yeah,
against Notts County, but has been very good for them. I think the goals up front are key. They've got Danny Hilton, who's scored goals at that level regularly, but also James Collins signed in the summer. He scored 20 goals for Crawley last season. So yeah, there's obviously goals in the team. They've had the odd strange result. They lost to the bottom club Barnet, but on the whole, you would have to say 49 goals scored.
It's all right. Should be said, though, the game on Saturday really wasn't an entertaining game. I can't recall seeing a football match more like a heavyweight boxing bout. Not because it was particularly violent, but both sides full of respect for each other, sort of sounding each other out, and the goals from set pieces. I mean, you watch that game, though, and you watch, I mean, both teams, Luton and Notts County, they look like shoo-ins for automatic promotion, don't they?
Yeah, you would have thought so. It's probably not the game that it was billed as, but I don't think either of them would have been disappointed with the result.
I was very surprised Luton didn't go up last season. Adam, they're going up this season, aren't they?
I think so. The setup there is good. They say it's championship level setup, and Nathan Jones talking himself up for Barcelona, won the Barcelona job at some point this week. So, yeah, I think big ambitions.
What is their level? Because it's such a strange stadium, isn't it? I mean, you know, one of the gates is literally built into a row of terraced houses. We had people on Twitter last night telling us stories of going to the away toilets and being able to see into people's kitchens. They're not going back to the top flight in that stadium, are they?
No, they're not. They've got a new training facility, which is top-notch. They're in real dire need of a new stadium. And even 15 years ago, one of my friends went to sign for them, and he said he walked in the dressing room. Some tiles were missing from the dressing room ceiling. You know, all the, like, sort of insulation's falling down. It says he didn't have to talk to them. He just walked in and then walked straight back out again. And nothing much has changed, really. It's still quite the same, but they have got a great support there. You know, and they do fill it. Even when they're going there with Lincoln in the conference in the National League, it was they still fill the stadium, and still a great atmosphere. But they really, really do need to move to a new stadium.
It's a massive catchment area as well, particularly with the people who can't afford houses in London, which is pretty much everybody right now, all heading out to Bedfordshire. So lots of potential, but yeah, they certainly do need a new stadium. I tell you what, if you want to go see them, cheapest matchday ticket is £18 and kids' prices from £3 to £9. There's hardly any parking at Kenilworth Road itself, but the ground's a 20-minute walk from the town centre, and as the club website proudly proclaims, as of last month, 2020 developments in association with RCP Car Parks opened a new car park at Power Court in Luton, bringing another 500 much-needed spaces to the town centre. With excellent introductory offers available for parking at just 50p an hour, we'd highly recommend supporters use the facility on match days and throughout the week. Woof indeed, producer Ben. Right, it's time for Joe Crilly of William Hill. Joe, have you ever been to Kenilworth Road?
I have, actually. I've walked through the poor person's garden, through their terraced house to get into the away end. So I have indeed, yeah.
Have you ever done in a wee and looked in an old lady's kitchen? At Kenilworth Road, I should say, not in general.
Right, OK, I'm glad you clarified that. I can't remember. It was a good few years ago. I can't remember whether I used the facilities, but as David said, the ground is rather dilapidated. But yeah, they're playing very well this season, aren't they?
They are playing very well. We're going to get some odds off you in a moment. But let's start with Bristol City. We're not sure about automatic promotion. What odds can you get on it?
OK, so obviously Wolves and Cardiff are streets ahead in the betting. Wolves massively odds on to actually win the title. Cardiff 5-1 to win the title. Bristol City 20-1 to finish top, third favourites. And halve that, 10-1 for automatic promotion. But if you are looking for a promotion anyway, automatic or through the playoffs, they're 2-1. And I think that price is a lot shorter because of the fact that they have now opened up a 7-point gap between 7th place and themselves. So I think even now, after 21 games, I think they are looking like they will cement a place in the playoffs.
These are certainly a lot more positive odds than they would have got this time last year.
They've
taken great steps. Charlton, I'm, you know, with the best will in the world, I'm not convinced they're going up this season. Am I wrong?
Again, they're like Bristol City. They're third favourites in both markets. So I think it's just based on the size of the club. I mean, you tend to see a lot of the bigger clubs doing very, very well come the end of the season. I know Charlton have been scratching around for a couple of years now in League One, but they are they're 4-1 for promotion, and a rather lumpy 10-1 again for automatic promotion.
All right, Luton. You wouldn't even take my money for a bet on Luton to go up, would you?
No, they're actually 4-7 to win the division, ahead of Notts County, who are 4-1, which is bizarre considering they're on the same points at the moment. And automatic 1-12. But I was having a chat with one of my former colleagues who is a massive Luton fan, season ticket holder for about 30 years. And he said, whilst they look like one of the best Luton teams that he's seen in a very, very, very long time, he wouldn't be putting his money on odds on for them to win the league. He said, he's fully confident that they will get automatic promotion, but At 4-7, he would much rather go for the 4-1 for Notts County.
No, I think that's fair. I think they're going up. I'm not sure if they'll win the title. Let's turn our attention to the TV games. Sheffield Wednesday against Wolves. Sheffield Wednesday in all sorts of bother now, aren't they?
Yeah, and I noticed that there's been a lot of chat on social media over the last few weeks about the future of Carlos Carvajal. If you remember, a few weeks back, he had what people were calling a bit of a breakdown when he got some money out of his pocket. Did he rip it up or fold it up or something ridiculous? Anyway, and playing Wolves on the run of form that they're on at the moment is not what they want to be doing. The away side, 11-10, so their odds against there, which to me looks like a decent price, but then Wolves only went and drew against Sunderland last week.
Adam, are you worried that Sunderland result might precipitate a wobble, or was it just something that happened?
No, I think Wolves were very dominant in that game, and it's probably going to be a thing where if teams are completely defending, I think Nuno was not very happy with Chris Coleman's just shutting shop. I don't think Sheffield Wednesday will do that on Friday, will they, at home? So,
no, I think not. Cardiff against Hull. Cardiff coming back to rescue a point last night. Even with Neil Warnock sent off. Nigel Adkins, though, just taken over at Hull and wins his first game. Tight one.
Yes, very much so. Although the odds don't suggest that. Hull 9-2. Cardiff odds on at 8-13 with the draw 14-5. And if I was to have a bet, I would go for that draw. Hull looked shaky at the back, but looked good going forward. And Cardiff have been obviously very good all season. So I think there could be goals in this one. The 14-5 appeals to me.
And finally, White Christmas. What can we get?
Yeah, it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, even in London. Yeah.
Now, in order for it to be an official White Christmas, it has to be, was it a flake of snow landing on the roof of the Met Office building?
Yeah, so what we did is we offer odds on 15 different cities in the UK. And so you can have a bet individually on any one of those cities. And obviously the prices fluctuate.
Can you have some kind of snow accumulator?
You can't, because it's what's called a related contingency. So obviously if there was snow in one place, it's a lot more likely to snow in the other. But we've priced all of these 15 cities, Aberdeen, Edinburgh, Glasgow, 7-4. They're the favourites. The outsider of Penzance at 8-1. But we've collected them all together. And if it snows in one of them, it's odds on, actually. So 8-13 for snow in any one of the 15 cities.
I always feel sorry, because presumably there must be some guy on the Met Office roof, like from morning till night on Christmas Day. And
all day with his finger in the air waiting for a single snowflake.
Any minute now. Thank you ever so much, Joe. If we want to follow you on Twitter, how do we do it?
@footy_Joe.
@footy_Joe. Right, there's just about enough time for any other questions. Ollie Warner, he says, David, who's the best young keeper in the Football League? Tom Smith also asks, is Ben Amos the best keeper? So we'll do a kind of combo move.
Well, we'll go along with that theme of ex-Manchester United keepers, and we'll say Sam Johnson, simply because it's difficult coming from a big club and being taken out of that environment and then getting used to, because you think footballers are in a bubble. When you're in a club like Manchester United, that's like a strong bubble. It's like a balloon more than a bubble, really. And
Zeppelin.
Exactly, yeah. So it's good to see that he's getting games now in a good club like Villa, and you know, having the pressure of playing for a big club, another big club, but in meaningful games, and that's what it's all about.
They produce a few, don't they? Dean Henderson doing very well at Shrewsbury as well.
I'll take your word for it there, because, I mean, you've obviously, in your goalkeeper expert knowledge.
Well, absolutely.
I've sort of
didn't sign for Falmouth Town for nothing, you know. Didn't play for Falmouth Town. Wanted to concentrate on smoking. Paul Calf. All right, well, that's just about all we've got time for. David, thank you so much. You had less than 24 hours to prepare for this and acquitted yourself magnificently.
Oh, just the same time frame I use for all my shows.
Where can we find you on Twitter?
I am at DavidPriest12.
Excellent. Adam Bate, only slightly longer preparation time, played a blinder on your debut. Where can we find you on Twitter?
@GhostGoal.
Is that in reference to Liverpool-Chelsea?
Yeah, people think that. It's just a relic of an old blog name that a friend of mine started many years ago.
Oh, very nice. Thank you to Joe for coming in. Thank you very much. Producer Ben, I never usually thank, but has a thankless task making sense of those Cheltenham and Luton histories. And thank you to you, dear listener, for listening. See you next Tuesday.
The Totally Football League Show is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email us at sales@muddyneesmedia.com.